or surprise. It could have been trepidation. He clearly knew what I was doing here. His entire body gave off the knowledge of it. He slid one hand into his pocket and began walking toward me. I could see bits of gray shining in it. When he got to the easel, he dropped the sack and squatted beside my painting, relieved, I think, to have something to do. "It's good," he said. "Very unusual." I moved my thumb around the base of my finger, the place where my wedding ring had been. The skin felt bare and newly grown, tender. He pretended to study the painting.
"I hope you don't mind my coming here to paint," I said.
"I would have asked your permission, but, well, it's not like I could pick up the phone and call you." "You don't have to ask my permission," he said. "This place belongs to everybody." He stood up, but continued to look down at the picture with his back to me. Around us, the grasses rippled and swayed as though underwater. I wanted to go and slide my arms around him, press my face against his back, say, "It's okay. It is. We were meant for this." But I couldn't be the one who said it. He had to hear it some other way from inside himself. He had to believe in the rightness of it, as I did. He looked painfully stiff, standing there, and I wondered if he was struggling to hear the voice that would tell him what to do. The voice that would not be wrong. Or if he was only barricading himself. I told myself I would stand there in my bare feet one more minute, when it would be plain that the only dignified thing to do was put on my boots, gather up my art, and leave. I would paddle back and never speak of this again. He turned around abruptly, almost as if he'd heard my thought. I stepped toward him, close enough to smell the saltiness coming from his chest, the damp circles under his arms. Light blazed up in the blue of his eyes. He reached out and pulled me to him, wrapping his arms around me. "Jesse," he whispered, pushing his face into my hair. I closed my eyes and put my mouth at the opening of his shirt, let my lips open and close on his skin, tasting the flesh at the hollow of his throat, the taste of heat. I unfastened each small white button and kissed the skin beneath it. The wooden cross dangled over his breastbone, and I had to move it to one side in order to kiss the bone's small arch. "Wait," he said, and pulled the leather cord over his head, letting the cross drop to the ground. When I reached the button tucked inside his belt, I tugged his shirt out of his jeans and kept unbuttoning until he stood with his shirt wide open, a soft wind lifting the edges of it. He leaned over and kissed me. His mouth tasted like wine left over from Mass. He led me into the flecked light of the hermitage, took off his shirt, and spread it on the ground, then undressed me, lifting the t-shirt over my head, unsnapping my khakis, pulling them into a puddle around my ankles. I stepped out of them and stood in my light blue panties and matching bra and let him stare at me. He looked first at the indentation of my waist, that curve where it flares out to my hips, then glanced back at my face for a moment before letting his eyes wander to my breasts, then downward toward my thighs. I stood unmoving, but there was an avalanche going on. An entire history sliding away. He said, "I can't believe how beautiful you are." I started to say, "No, no, I'm not," but stopped myself. Instead, I unhooked my bra and let it fall down next to his cross. I watched him stoop and unlace his boots. The skin on his shoulders was glazed with sunburn. He stood up, barefoot, bare-chested, his jeans low on his hips. "Come here," he said. And I went and leaned into the smoothness of his chest. "I've wanted you from the beginning,"
he told me. And the way he said it, his eyes fixed on my face, a frown of purpose across his forehead, sent a tremor through me. He lowered me to the ground on top of his denim shirt and kissed the soft places on my throat, my breasts, my thighs. We made love with the tide sweeping in around the island and Max asleep in the sun. There was a mystifying scent in the air, like burned sweetness. I decided later it was a smell of wisteria floating out from the island. As he moved above me, I heard the high-pitched call of an osprey coming from the height of clouds. I heard crab claws scurrying in the brush. The ground was lumpy, gristly with vines and sprouting fan palms. One of them was jabbing into my shoulder, and my body had goose-pimpled over in the cool air from the deep, cobalt shadows at the back of the lean-to. I began to tremble. Wit slid his hand under my shoulder, cradling it away from the pointy shoots on the palm. He said, "You all right?" I nodded. I didn't mind any of it. I wanted to be here, lying on a tide-swept piece of earth, belonging to it, watched by the marsh, by the birds circling our heads. He smiled at me, touching my face with his other hand, tracing the rim of my jaw, my lips and nose. He burrowed his face into my neck and breathed deeply, and I disappeared into the moment. Wit, the blood and bones in my body, the wildness of loving him. I inhabited those moments in a way that was usually lost to me. They came through an amplifier that made the movement of our bodies and the pulsing world around us more vivid and radiant, more real. I could even feel how perishable all my moments really were, how all my life they had come to me, begging to be lived, to be cherished even, and the impassive way I'd treated them. Later, I would think that if sex was really a conversation, a way of communicating something, what was it we had said to each other? Where had those desperate, eloquent voices come from? Afterward, I lay beside him, still nude, warmed by his body, which gave off surprising waves of heat. There were smudges of mud on my hips, tiny green myrtle leaves pressed onto the backs of my legs. Max roused himself, wandered over, and curled up on the other side of me. "I feel like that woman in the Gauguin painting," I said. He tightened his arm around me. "Which one?" "That exotic island woman he was always painting. You know, usually she wore a red sarong." He glanced at the turtle skull I'd placed on the crab trap and smiled. Then he moved his finger along the gully between my breasts. I saw that his knuckle was bleeding from tiny punctures made by the sharp points of the fan palm. I heard Max start to snore. Wit's eyes drifted closed. I could not understand drowsiness after sex. The cells in my own body were simmering in adrenaline. When he began to breathe in the heavy way of sleep, I lay there and listened. The afternoon floated on the tide, pulled along like flotsam. Wit slept. I watched him. I watched everything with a kind of wonder. Once, a blur of white wings plummeted toward the creek, a diving osprey falling like an angel toward the water. I felt evicted from my old life. No, not evicted, sprung, free. I lay there, the Gauguin woman, held in the lushness of what had happened, feeling content, alive. Only once did I think of Hugh, and a spasm of shock swept through me, the rebound of my other life, the terrible moral wrongness of what I'd done. I cupped myself tightly against Wit's side until it passed. When he woke, the sun was arching toward the west. From under the lean-to, I could see citron colors flooding along the horizon. He sat up. "It's late.
I have to get back for Vespers. As I reached for my clothes, he said, Are you sorry about this?
I don't have any regrets, I told him. But it wasn't true. I regretted that I was married, that I would end up hurting Hugh. Had already hurt him. That Dee could be hurt. That all the glue that had held us together for so long was coming apart. But I didn't regret what we'd done. I should have, I suppose, but I didn't. I knew I would do it again. Unless he was sorry. I didn't ask him whether he was or not. I didn't want to know. I couldn't bear thinking he might go to Vespers now and beg God to forgive him. Chapter 24. Wit. He did not go to Vespers. He did not go to Compline either. He crossed the cloister to his cottage, walking quickly. Inside, he sat at his desk without turning on the lamp and watched the darkness grow beyond the window, the quiet way it swallowed the trees. He had not been touched for so long. Years. He'd had a kind of erotic jolt. At least that's how he would describe it in his notebook. When he could no longer distinguish the shape of the trees, he flipped on the lamp and wrote it all down. Everything that had happened. What he felt inside. He shouldn't have chanced putting it in writing, but he couldn't help it. Feelings had always been strange, inscrutable markings in his heart, like the ones he'd seen on the Rosetta Stone once. He'd stared at the stone for a very long time, while at least 100... Maybe 1,000 other museum tourists had come and gone. He'd felt he was looking at something deeply personal, and from then on, he'd been trying to decipher the emotional scribbles inside himself by writing them down. Oddly, they became accessible that way, transposed into something deeply felt. Like now. He could feel her hands on his back, see her body stretched across the ground, the goose flesh on her breasts. He could feel himself vanishing inside her again. He put down his pen and stood up, needing to move. He paced from one side of his bed to the other, glancing at the crucifix nailed over the head. The bed was a simple mattress on a metal frame and took up most of the room. He wished he could lie down on the scratchy brown blanket and go instantly to sleep. He dreaded the long night to come. He'd made love to a woman. He didn't know how to go about his life in the Abbey after that. He lowered the Venetian blinds on the casement windows and sat again at his desk. He tried to be practical, to dissect the situation. He wrote down logical-sounding premises for what had happened. That being with Jesse was a way to fill the loss of Linda. Or, now that he was on the brink of taking final vows, he was looking for a way out. Maybe his libido had been forced into such rigid denial that it had suddenly flipped to the other extreme. It even occurred to him that poets and monks had been using sexual imagery to write about their union with God for centuries. Could he have been looking for some consummation with God? He read back over all the possible reasons he'd come up with, and they sounded ridiculous to him. They made him think of St. Thomas Aquinas and his Summa Theologica, which his novice master thought was sublime. And yet, on his deathbed, Aquinas himself had said that all of it was nothing but straw compared with the things he'd experienced, the things in his heart. That's how Wit felt, as if his reasoning was a lot of straw, a lot of bullshit. He'd done this unbelievable thing because he loved her. He wanted her. That's what he knew. He knew that life had erupted in him again, felt how much of a crater his heart had been before meeting her. He closed the notebook and opened Yeats, and it fell open to that passage he read and reread. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. He got up and
washed his face and hands in the sink. There were small cuts across his knuckles. He cleaned them with soap, then took off his shirt and held it to his nose and sniffed. He could smell her. Could smell what they'd done. Instead of dropping it into the small laundry hamper, he hung it on the peg beside his extra shirts and robes. Compline was over, and the great silence had begun. The monks would be sealed in their rooms now. He'd heard Dominic come in half an hour earlier, heard the typewriter start up. Whit slid a t-shirt over his head and put on his coat. He opened the door and closed it quietly behind him. He did not take a flashlight, only his rosary. It rattled in his pocket as he walked. The gilt edge of a new moon hung in the sky, and he knew there would be a spring tide in a few hours. It would spill out of the needle grass like a broth overflowing its bowl. Out on the hummock, where he'd made love to Jesse, the water would flood within 20 feet of his hermitage. On the nights Whit couldn't sleep, he walked the stations of the cross. It took his mind off things, it calmed him. And he liked that the stations were not in the church, that they were simple cement plaques arranged like flagstones on the ground. He loved the serpentine path they made through the oaks behind the cottages, and the animals he sometimes glimpsed when he was walking, the sudden red glow of their eyes. He had seen striped skunks, red foxes, owls, and once a bobcat. At the first station, he took out his rosary, touched it to his forehead, and knelt beside the crude etching of Jesus standing before Pontius Pilate. Jesus is condemned to die. The abbot had said they must enter into the scenes when they walked the stations, become part of them, but he could barely keep his mind focused. He closed his eyes and tried to remember the prayer he was supposed to say at the first station. He didn't know how he could not see her again. Right now, he wanted to run the distance to her mother's house and knock on her window as if he were 17. He wanted to slide into her bed and wedge his knees behind her knees, twine his fingers with her fingers, mold his body against hers, and tell her what he felt. He looked at the stone on the ground. He wanted to know if Jesus had struggled like this, had loved a woman this way. He wanted to think so. At the second station, Jesus carries his cross, Whit knelt again, more determined this time. He said the appointed prayer and contemplated the scene, shaking his head violently when the pictures of her came. He was bent over the sixth station, Veronica wipes the face of Jesus, when he caught the beam of a penlight darting through the darkness and a figure moving toward him. He rose to his feet. The figure was robed, he could tell that much, but with the deep shadows on the face, Whit didn't know that it was Father Sebastian until the father was practically standing in front of him. The light cut across Whit's face.
"So here you are," Sebastian said. "I just came from your cottage. I've been looking for you. You weren't at Vespers, you weren't at dinner, and mystery of mysteries, you weren't at Compline. Now, solve this great dilemma for me and explain where you were."
The tone in his voice made Whit uneasy, wary. It was almost as if he were being baited, as if Sebastian already knew. But how could he? Whit looked up at the sprinkling of stars over his head, then at Sebastian, who had folded his arms over his scapular and was staring at Whit through the bottom of his massive glasses. Sebastian had come from his cottage. Had he gone inside? Looked in Whit's notebook?
"So, I'm waiting," the older monk said. "Were you ill? If you were, you appear to have made a nice recovery."
"I wasn't ill, Father."
"What then?"
"I was in the rookery."
"You were in the rookery? Well, isn't that nice? Were you having fun out there while the rest of us were in choir doing our duty?"
"I'm sorry I missed choir."
"Look, Brother Thomas, I'm the prior, responsible for the discipline of this monastery. I'm the one who's to make sure there's no wrong behavior. I'll not tolerate it, You understand?
If he doesn't know, he surely suspects something.
Whit didn't respond. He stood still through a long silence, refusing to avoid Sebastian's eyes. He would not feel tawdry about this. It wasn't that he didn't feel blameworthy, he did. The moment he'd returned from the rookery, from loving her, the guilt had crashed down on him, incisive and powerful. The need to be forgiven stunning him with its severity. And yet, some part of him felt impenitent, belonging only to her, an impervious piece of him that the Abbey, even God, did not own and could not touch. He looked away from Sebastian at the final 8 stations dispersed through the oaks, glowing faintly on the ground, and beyond them, the enclosing wilderness of marsh. He thought, what a consolation this place had been. His confinement had been a freedom, a home, a dark and graceful poverty. What would he do if the place he most wanted to be was no longer the Abbey, but a woman's heart?
I don't know if I belong here, Whit said, and his voice cracked on the last word, here.
Sebastian watched Whit wipe at the thin film of tears that formed over his eyes, waiting as he cleared his throat and grasped for composure. When the older monk spoke again, his expression had changed, his face disarmed. The ugliness was drained from his voice.
I see.
He shifted his feet, reached beneath his glasses to rub his eyelids. As his glasses settled again on his nose, he said,
I want you to walk the rest of the stations. If you like, you can do it on your knees as a penance. But do it mainly as a way of reflecting on your call. Ask yourself why you came here. What it means to you to be hidden here with God. Every one of us has wondered if we belong here, Brother Thomas. We've all had to give up something or someone.
He looked at the ground.
You must carry your cross, you know. We all must.
Whit nodded at him. He wanted to say, but I don't know what my cross is. Is it doing without her now that I've loved her? Or is it doing without the Abbey? Or is it the peculiar agony of being spiritual and human at the same time?
When you finish the stations, go to bed and get your rest, said Sebastian. You wouldn't want to miss Lauds in the morning. The word means return of the light. May that be so for you.
Yes, Father, he said. He waited for Sebastian to leave, wondering if he would go to the abbot or keep all of this to himself. Sinking to his knees, he walked on them to the next station. Jesus Falls the Second Time. Whit repeated fragments of the Laudate Psalms. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord preserves all who love him. Praise the Lord, O my soul. Then pieces of the Song of Zechariah. The day shall dawn upon us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness. Whit wanted the light to come, the light Sebastian spoke of. But he wanted more to lie down in his own heart and hold the dark.
Chapter 25. The morning after I made love to Whit O'Connor, I came into the kitchen and found Mother with the hibiscus scarf draped around the collar of her bathrobe, cooking gulla rice purlough. 4 giant aluminum stockpots of it, enough for a monastery. She lifted the lid on the largest pot, and tears of white smoke wafted out, smelling like shrimp and andouille sausage. What are you doing? I asked. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. I wanted coffee. I wanted to sit in the kitchen all by myself and sip it slowly.
I'm cooking for the monks. We'll need to get the purlough over there by 11, before Brother Timothy starts fixing lunch. I'll need to warm it up.
Set out some bread and make sweet tea.
Recipe books were spread across the kitchen table, mingled with onion skins, shrimp tails, and spatterings of Carolina gold rice kernels. If she hadn't looked so herself, standing there with an Our Lady of the Miraculous medal pinned to the scarf, waving a wooden spoon in the air as she talked, I might have protested at how crazy it was to cook the dish here and then have to haul it over there.
"How are we getting all this over to the Abbey?" I asked.
"We'll drive it through the main gate in the golf cart," she seemed exasperated at having to point out the obvious to me. I took my coffee mug to the front porch and sat in one of the wicker chairs with a quilt drawn around my shoulders. The clouds were light and spongy, floating high and soaked in a bronzy shade of gold. I slid my spine low in the chair so I could stare at them. I'd slept without dreaming, waking once in an icy sweat, permeated by the same terror-struck feeling that had seized me momentarily as I lay beside Wit in the aftermath of what we'd done. These paroxysms were, I realized later, a kind of aftershock. They would come and go for weeks, moments of violent disorientation in which I couldn't recognize myself, completely breaking apart how I understood my life, all the joints and couplings that held it together. It was the peculiar vertigo, the peculiar humility that comes from realizing what you are really capable of. Those aftershocks would gradually taper off, but in the beginning, they could almost paralyze me. Last night, the feeling had taken much longer to pass than it had on the island with Wit. Sitting on the side of the bed, trying to steady myself, I'd noticed the painting I'd done propped against the wall by the door, the underwater sheen on the woman's face glowing slightly, making her look half alive. The sight unnerved me, and I got up and stood in front of the dresser. The pincushion was there, my wedding rings pinned to it like insects, like specimens of a valuable but discarded life. Gazing into the mirror, I saw myself as I was, a black silhouette in the room, a woman whose darkness had completely leaked through. What if I lose Hugh and Wit both? What if I give up Hugh only to have Wit turn away? I'll be alone, abandoned. That was the deep, silent terror, wasn't it? The hole that would always need filling. Standing there, I recognized how time-worn and venerable it was, stretching beyond Hugh, beyond Wit, going all the way back to my father. This morning, though, there was none of that reverberating fear from the night before. I watched the clouds from the porch and thought of Wit, the bliss of our lovemaking, this new other life waiting for me. I had the sense of being out on the furthest frontier of myself. It was, despite those intermittent convulsions, a surprisingly beautiful outpost. I'd done something unthinkable, and yet I didn't regret it. I felt pulled unaccountably, almost forcibly, to Wit, and yes, there was transgression and betrayal and wrongness in it, but also mystery and what felt like holiness, an actual holiness. Driving to the Abbey, we spotted Hepzibah in front of the Star of the Sea Chapel. She was holding her gullah drum, standing on the porch of the little clapboard church, talking to about a dozen people. We'd come upon her grand gullah tour. I pulled up behind the group and stopped, wanting to hear a little bit of what she was saying, wondering if she actually beat the drum for them the way she used to do for us at the all-girls picnic. She was telling them the chapel was built on the ruins of a church for freed slaves. She walked back and forth while she talked, tapping the drum softly with her fingers. I stared at her elaborate head wrap and caftan made from toffee-colored fabric covered with small zebras. She wore her famous hoop earrings. Cat had said once they were big enough for a cat to jump through, but I liked them on her.
There's an old Gullah practice, she was saying. Before our people can become church members, they go to a sacred place in the woods 3 times a day for a week and meditate on the state of their souls. We call it traveling, because we're traveling inside. She hit her drum with the flat of her hand and motioned the group into the chapel to look around. When they were inside, she walked over and hugged Nell first, then me. As Mother got out to check the cord we'd used to anchor the pots on the back seat, Hepzibah leaned close to me.
How are you, Jessie?
It was not simply a polite question. Her eyes searched mine. I knew she wondered if I'd been with Wit in the rookery. If I'd found the turtle skull she'd left under the canoe. I'm fine. Everything's fine, I said. I wish I could hear the rest of the tour, but we're taking lunch to the monastery.
Did you go for that canoe ride? She asked.
I felt heat rise on the skin of my cheeks. Yesterday, I said. Thank you for the turtle skull, I added, thinking how I'd left it in Wit's hermitage as a talisman, hoping it would bring me back. Mother was climbing into the cart.
Hold on tight to it, Hepzibah whispered.
The monastery kitchen was a bright old room with long beveled pane windows and oak cabinets with small Celtic crosses burned into the bottom corners. It had not changed much since I was a child, playing sous chef to Mother. We'd stood at the work table in the center of the room while she'd held out her hand and called out, "Potato masher, pastry cutter, apple corer." I'd snapped each item into her palm as if she were the surgeon and I the nurse. Our cooking operation, as she called it, was serious business. We were feeding the holy. The sight of the work table filled my chest with a dull ache. I paused a moment, holding the perlo, staring at the scarred surface. The same dented copper pots dangled over it from the ceiling, catching light from the window. Was this where Mother had done it? Where she'd stretched out her finger and brought down the meat cleaver, severing it right through the bone? Here, on our old operating table? I set the pot on the stove and walked to the large stainless steel sink, where I ran cold water over my hands. I was dabbing the back of my neck when Brother Timothy appeared, just in time to haul in the last stock pot. He seemed excessively excited by Mother's sudden, unexpected return, chattering to her about egg deliveries and the lack of decent tomatoes. He followed her around the kitchen as she opened and closed drawers, rummaged inside the industrial-sized refrigerator, and sniffed several clusters of oregano drying on a counter. He walked with a shuffle, his body pitched forward like someone barreling into a windstorm. Mother took a clean but heavily stained apron from a peg near the pantry door and tied it around her. She flicked on the gas burners and bent to peer at the blue fire that licked the bottoms of the pots.
"I was told you two were in here," a voice said behind us. "The entire abbey is in a jubilant uproar over whatever it is you've got in those pots."
Father Dominic stood just inside the doorway, looking flushed and a little anxious. He'd come so quickly he'd forgotten his straw hat. An array of long white hairs were spread carefully over his balding scalp. I could not remember seeing my mother and Dominic in a room together since the day he'd come to our house bearing the remains of my father's drowned boat. Now I watched them carefully, the way Mother took an automatic step backward when she saw him, her hand coming up to touch the side of her neck. Dominic looked at Brother Timothy.
"Could you go and fill the water pitchers in the refectory? And check the salt shakers."
Outranked, Timothy shrugged and crossed the kitchen, the scuff of his shoes sounding loud and sullen. When he was gone, Dominic lifted his hand to the top of his head, where he patted the web of hairs, assuring himself everything was still plastered in place. He scarcely looked at me, all his attention on Mother. I watched his eyes drift to her injured hand and take in the flesh-colored ace bandage that had replaced the bulky gauze.
"I'm glad you feel well enough to cook for us again, Nell. We've missed you."
It came back to me, how he'd said, "our Nell," the last time we'd talked, as if he possessed some part of her. Mother wiped her hands back and forth on the front of her apron.
"I'm glad to be back," she said,
her words frosted, clipped off on the ends, that tone she got when she was repelled. I knew it well. She whirled around then and began savagely stirring the rice. Dominic folded and unfolded his hands several times. His knuckles were enormous and splotched with redness. Arthritis, I imagined. He offered me a strained smile.
"Knock, knock," he said.
I stood a moment, wondering how to respond to this silly, relentless game of his. The rice started to sputter over the heat. "I don't think I want to play," I told him, borrowing a little of Mother's tone. It would have been absurd to go along, but I also felt I was being loyal to her. Clearly, she wanted no part of him. And yet, she turned around, embarrassed, I suppose, by my rudeness, my refusal to humor him. "Who's there?" she said, and cut her eyes at me. After all her showy repugnance, it was the last thing I expected. Now I felt she'd been disloyal to me. Dominic hesitated before going on, but I realized later it was only because he was discarding the joke he'd had in mind for me, and coming up with a fresh new one meant only for her. Something daring and strangely intimate.
"Orange," he said.
She pressed her lips tightly together and lifted her chin a little.
"Orange who?"
He walked within an arm's length of her, positioning himself so I could not see his face. He dropped his voice, hoping I would not hear him, but I did hear. Barely.
"Aren't you ever going to forgive us?"
Mother's face was taut, giving nothing away.
"And aren't you ever going to leave so I can cook in peace?" she responded.
She hustled into the pantry and returned with a bag of cornmeal. "Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to make hoe cakes."
"Hoe cakes," Dominic exclaimed. "Saints preserve us. We don't deserve you."
He sauntered toward the door, but after a few paces paused and looked back at me.
"Oh, Jesse, I almost forgot. There's someone in the library who would like a word with you."
I crossed the cloister quadrangle, forcing my limbs to move with unassuming casualness, the stroll of someone wandering over to the library to browse around. That was all. I paused inside the door before a small statue of Saint Benedict, holding his rule, and made myself read the wall plaque beside it, the way I imagined a devout visitor would do.
"Listen, my son, to your master's precepts, and incline the ear of your heart."
My own heart was buffeting around in my chest, hammering wildly. Pellets of light from a window over the door bounced around on the pinewood floor. I took a long breath, trying to find my equilibrium. I began to wander up and down the tunnels of books, pausing once in a while to crook my head sideways and read the titles. "On Contemplating God," by William of St. Thierry. Lucretius's Nature of the Universe. The Collected Works of St. John of the Cross. I listened for footsteps. Where was he? By the time I arrived at the reading area in the back of the library, the charged feeling inside had only intensified. I sat down at one of three tables that faced an expansive window. The tabletop had been polished with such enterprise that I could see myself reflected in the buffed wood. My hair was a mess. I smoothed it down with my hands, then changed my mind and tried to fluff it up. I gazed through the window, and the scene outside formed in my mind like a canvas. Splotches of fuchsia azaleas tucked against the whitewashed house where the monks made nets. A Japanese maple, blue-tinged grass, a tiny knoll creased with shadow. A door creaked behind me, and I turned to see Whit standing in the entrance of a small office that was situated just off the reading room. Father Dominic's office, it turned out. He was wearing his robe and his rookery boots. My eyes went to the place on his neck I had kissed. When I stepped into the office, he closed the door behind us, clicking the lock, and we stood for a moment in the cramped space with the smell of paraffin drifting from a candle on a wall sconce behind him. A fluorescent light hummed noisily over our heads. I noticed that the blinds were closed against the only window, and the artificial glare felt glowering and oppressive. Impulsively, I reached over and flicked the switch, watching his face as the room plunged into a soft dimness. A feeling of profound belonging, of intimacy, washed over me. I pictured him on the marsh island, pressed against me, loving me. The breathing world around us again, the inviolate bond we'd made. I went and laid my face against his shoulder and felt his arms, the voluminous sleeves of his robe come up slowly to enfold me. "Jesse," he said after a moment. "The library is usually empty now, but we need to be careful." He glanced at the door, and I realized the enormous risk he was taking. "I only have 15 minutes before choir, but I had to see you." I lifted my head from his shoulder and looked up at him. Even in the half-light, I saw the tiny smudges of shadow beneath his eyes, and his posture seemed oddly stiff, as if his lungs had expanded and gotten stuck. I was, I realized, terrified of what was going on inside him, his monkness, the power of what had brought him to the Abbey. If we were going to be together, and I wanted this now, with something close to desperation, he would have to want it too, in that same way he'd wanted God, and I didn't know if I could compete with that. I didn't want to be one of those mythological sirens who lured sailors onto the rocks, or, more to the point, like the mermaid Asinora, who lured monks to their fall. I wanted to touch his face, to find the opening to his robe, but I made myself take a tiny step backward. "Could you meet me tomorrow at 2, at the dock in the rookery?" he was saying. "Of course. I'll be there," I told him. Silence again. He had his left hand resting loosely on my waist as we'd talked, but he withdrew it, and I watched him brush his finger across the front of his robe at what I realized was one of my own long brown hairs. "It's wonderful having your mother cooking for us again," he said. "I suppose that's a sign that she's mending. So, we were going to make common talk. We were going to stand in this little room, no longer suffused in wan romantic hues, but only in ordinary dimness, and use innocuous conversation as a defense." "Her hand is nearly mended," I said, "but I worry that her mind may never be." He glanced at a digital clock on the desk, sitting beside a little stack of Dominic's booklet, The Mermaid's Tale. There was a painfully conspicuous pause in which he cleared his throat. What was this heaviness in him? Caution? It could not be easy for him. Or was his demeanor, this tepidness, a reversal of some sort? Had he been so decimated by guilt that he was trying to return things to the way they were before? Was he simply scared? "After Nell did what she did," he said, "many of us couldn't help but think of the scripture where Jesus talks about cutting off one's hand." His words startled me. "There's a verse in scripture about that?" He scanned a wall shelf, retrieved a Bible, and began flipping the pages. "Here it is. It's part of Christ's Sermon on the Mount. If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off, and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell." I took the book out of his hands and read the words silently to myself, then snapped it shut. "That's it, isn't it? That's where she got the idea. Better to cut off her finger than have her whole body cast into hell." I shoved the Bible back onto the shelf. It was illogical, but I felt mildly indignant. "Jesus was speaking symbolically.
Obviously, he didn't mean for anyone to take his words literally, Whit said.
Well, don't you think he could have allowed for the possibility that a few crazy people might misinterpret his point? I mean, really, it's not the most responsible thing someone could say.
His lips twisted, as if trying to hold back laughter, and his whole body seemed to release its grip and breathe again. Finally, the laugh slipped out of him.
What? I said, starting to smile.
I've heard Jesus referred to as a lot of things, but that's the first time I've ever heard anyone suggest he was irresponsible.
He reached over and touched my hair, let his knuckles brush the curve of my cheek. His eyes were lit up, but not only with amusement. They glistened in the way I remembered from our lovemaking. As I leaned up to kiss him, a spark of static electricity leaped between us, and both of us jumped backward, laughing.
See what happens when you call Jesus irresponsible? I joked. You get shocked.
Seriously, he said. There are some bizarre accounts of saints mutilating themselves. They seem to get the inspiration for it from this verse.
I've been saying all along Mother was doing some kind of penance, even though Hugh thinks I'm wrong.
Hugh? He said. And the room went still.
I'd said his name automatically, stupidly. Why had I brought him into it? I'd assumed then it was a thoughtless moment, but I wondered about it in the days that followed. Had I wanted to say Hugh's name? To throw the worst at Whit and see what he'd do? Was I lining up the hurdles, the secret realities that lay between us? He had brought up Jesus. I had brought up Hugh.
Oh, I said, Hugh is a... He's my husband. He's a psychiatrist.
Whit looked away, back toward the day-blind window. He reached over and flipped the light back on, and we were plunged into a stinging brightness. Desperate to smooth over the moment, to usher us around Hugh's name, I kept on talking.
It's just that he thinks Mother's impulse to cut off her finger was a meaningless, random obsession.
He tried to smile, looking at me as if to say, All right, then. We'll go on as if nothing happened. He said, But you think it was penance for something particular?
Yes. I just don't know what for.
The casualness I was forcing into my voice sounded desperate.
I believe it goes back a long time. Actually, I suspect that Father Dominic knows what it is.
Dominic, he said sharply, then, glancing at the door, lowered his voice. What makes you think that?
First tell me what you think of him.
He's very genuine. A natural jokester, but he has a serious side, too. He tends to follow his own version of things, but I like that about him.
Now, what makes you think he knows anything about this?
Mother implied as much, I said. And a while ago in the kitchen, I heard Dominic ask her if she was ever going to forgive them.
Us, he said. Aren't you ever going to forgive us?
Whit shook his head, plainly bewildered. Forgiveness? For what?
I shrugged.
I wish I knew. I tried to talk to Dominic about it earlier, but he was very secretive. And Mother, well, she's not going to tell me anything. He looked again at the clock. I'm sorry, but I should have left 5 minutes ago.
Yes, go. I'll wait here a few minutes and then leave. When he'd gone, I stood in the middle of Dominic's office, in all that brittle light, and my mind went back to the moment when Whit had opened the Bible and read the verse to me out loud. The harsh words about severing one's hand in order to save the whole body. Had that reading been entirely about my mother? Or had he been thinking about the way he'd caressed my breast, my hip, tugged me against him? Was he, in his way, telling me something about us?
Chapter 26. A brown pelican perched on the bow of the monastery's John boat like a hood ornament, the S of its neck slumped onto its white breast. As I approached the rookery dock,
The bird unfurled its wings, the span of them outlandish, and held them wide open, air drying its feathers. Wit stood on the dock staring at the spectacle. He did not see me until I called his name, and as he turned, the pelican flapped her wings and took to the air. I didn't know what to expect, whether we would get in the boat and go back to his hermitage, or remain on the dock, whether he would pull me into his arms or sever me from his life. I'd sat up in bed the night before, jerked awake by a nightmare of amputated hands and fingers. There were piles of them in the rose garden at the monastery, heaped around St. Sonara's feet, all of them still wiggling, still alive. "Can you believe how beautiful the day is?" he said in a carefree way. "Do not talk about the weather. If you talk about the weather, I'll start screaming." "Yes, beautiful," I said. It was, actually, the most splendid day you could imagine. Brilliant, warm, that feeling of spring taking hold around us. I'd worn my jeans with a long-sleeved white shirt, and I was already hot and perspiring. Strands of hair were spit-plastered, as Dee would say, to my neck. I reached into the side pocket of my purse, pulled out the garnet baseball cap, and yanked it low over my forehead, then dug out my sunglasses. "How about a ride?" he asked, and when I nodded, he began untying the dock line, climbing into the boat. I noticed he'd already tucked his canvas bag under the seat. "Where's Max?" I asked. He looked back at the walkway and shrugged. "I guess he's abandoned me today. Maybe he's miffed that I horned in last time. As I recall, it was you he was cuddling up to after." He stopped abruptly, unable or unwilling to say the words, letting the sentence hang in the air. He guided the boat slowly through the creek while I sat in the bow seat, gazing straight ahead, aware of the thin scum of guilt and hesitancy that had formed, and knowing that the mention of Hugh's name the day before had helped create it. It had been 2 weeks since Hugh had walked away from me at the slave cemetery, and he hadn't called once during that time. He was bound to be hurt, and of course, angry. But I had a feeling he was also waiting me out. Hugh was the most patient person, always the champion of letting things settle, run their course, come slowly to a head, all pet phrases of his. I'm sure it was the psychiatrist in him, presiding as he did over the age-old mysteries of the human psyche. He'd told Dee a story once about a girl who'd found a cocoon and snipped off the end of it to let the butterfly out. How the poor creature had emerged with deformed wings. "You can't force things," he'd said to her. I'd told Hugh I wanted time apart, and by God, he was giving it to me. "We're separated, you know," I said, turning to Wit, "Hugh and I. We're taking time apart." He looked down into the flat bottom of the boat, then back at me, his face very grave, but I think grateful as well. He slowed the boat to idle speed, and everything grew much quieter. "How long have you been married?" he asked. 20 years. He was fingering his cross, unaware he was doing it. "Happily?" "Yes, happily, at first. But then, oh, I don't know. It's not that we were unhappy. People looking at us would have said it was a good marriage. Hugh and Jessie, they're so compatible. It wouldn't be untrue." I pulled off my sunglasses, wanting him to see my face, my eyes, wanting nothing between us. I listened a moment to the water gently slapping the boat. When he didn't comment, I went on. "You know how couples always say, 'We just grew apart?' That's what I wanted to say at first, to believe that my discontent came from the distance between us. It's logical to think that after 20 years, but I don't believe that was it. We didn't grow apart. We grew too much together, too enmeshed and dependent on each other. I guess I needed—" I stopped. I didn't know what to call it.
What comes to mind are ridiculous things like my own space, my independence, but they sound so shallow, they don't capture it.
I know, it's hard to explain an impulse like that. The day I told my law partners I was coming here, they laughed like I was joking.
He shook his head and smiled a little, as if the memory amused him.
I never could make them understand that what I needed was somehow to be alone with myself, in a spiritual way, I mean.
As he talked, his gaze had been on the twists and turns in the creek, but now he leveled it on me.
Around here they call it a solitude of being.
My eyes slowly began to fill up, because I did understand what he meant, because he was offering these words to me, a solitude of being, and they were perfect. Sliding my sunglasses onto my face, I turned back to face the creek, the bulging inrush of tide. 10 minutes later, Whit angled the boat off the creek into the tributary that led to the marsh island where we'd made love. I recognized it right away and looked over at him. He smiled in that way I'd come to love, the corners of his lips barely lifting. It seemed to me then that something had changed.